Well, that brings us to the third chapter in the unit, which is photosynthesis. And the opening slide just shows you some photosynthetic organisms as of the many that are out there. I just want you to not lose track of the fact that even though we naturally think of plants when we think of photosynthesis, that's mostly because we're terrestrial organisms, and so we kind of focus on things that live on land. But that's only recently. For most of the history of life on Earth, there was no life on the land. It started in the oceans, and that's the only place it was for a long time, and that's where photosynthesis was invented, so to speak, by bacteria. Bacteria were the original photosynthetic organisms, and there's still a lot of them. So not only did they come up with photosynthesis originally, but keep in mind that they are actually what turned into chloroplasts. Bacteria that were aerobic respirers turned into mitochondria by being engulfed and surviving that process. That's the endosymbiotic theory that we talked about. And then different bacteria that were photosynthetic got engulfed and survived that process to become the original chloroplasts. So the process already existed long before there were any plants or animals. But the plants are definitely major photosynthetic organisms now because there's so many of them on the land. Just keep in mind that not only are they not the only photosynthetic organisms, they're not even the only photosynthetic eukaryotes. Bacteria, of course, are not eukaryotic, right? They are prokaryotes. They invented photosynthesis. But plants are just one of several different kinds of eukaryotes that are photosynthetic. Now, what is the group, the name that we give to any eukaryotic organism that's not an animal, a plant, or a fungus? Right. And so there, in addition to plants, which of course are not protists because they're plants, there are eukaryotic photosynthesizers, protists that are photosynthetic, in other words. Not all protists are photosynthetic, but some are. And if you have a protist and it is photosynthetic, then we call it an alga. And there are different kinds of algae. There's brown algae, red algae, green algae. They can be huge, multicellular things, or they can be unicellular. So photosynthesis has been very successful in a lot of groups of organisms is the main point there. We are going to study it, though, starting with slide 2 and onward, from the viewpoint of the plant, even though really the important particulars of the process occur much the same way in other photosynthetic organisms. We're just studying it from plant's point of view. For a typical plant, the greenest part of the plant is the leaves. Now, there's exceptions to that, especially if you just go outside here and you see a lot of cacti around here, where their leaves are no longer photosynthetic at all. They've evolved into spines that protect the plant. And the part of a cactus that is photosynthetic is the stem, the green part. On any given plant, anything that's green on it is capable of photosynthesis. But for a typical plant, that's really concentrated, that greenness, in the leaves, the primary photosynthetic organ for most plants. And a typical leaf is kind of like a sandwich arrangement of materials, where the two pieces of bread, so to speak, are two layers of epidermal cells, just like our skin, basically. And then the filling of the sandwich is mainly made up of mesophyll cells that you see labeled there. The mesophyll cells are the cells that actually undergo photosynthesis within them. So you see one isolated mesophyll cell below it, and you can see that there's multiple chloroplasts. Each of those little green circles is a chloroplast. Typical mesophyll cell will have about 50 or so chloroplasts in it. But any cell anywhere in the plant that has chloroplasts is able to undergo photosynthesis. Before we leave this sandwich arrangement, notice that you can see on the bottom view, the same thing would be happening on the top, that epidermal layer is full of holes positioned here and there. Those holes are called stomata. That's a plural. The singular is stoma, which just means opening or mouth. A stoma is not a structure. It's simply the space between two cells, these brownish ones, called guard cells. And the guard cells can either swell or shrink to either open or close the stoma between them. The rest of the epidermis is pretty well sealed. It's waterproof and gasproof, which means that the cell, by controlling its stomata, is able to control what gases can get in and out. You can see CO2 going in and O2 coming out. That's because photosynthesis requires CO2, and it spits out O2 as a waste product. But also water vapor goes through the stomata. Okay. This should be review at this point, but when we look at an isolated chloroplast in detail here, remember that it is a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, just like a mitochondrion or a nucleus. So there's an outer membrane, and there's an inner membrane, which actually is continuous with the thylakoid membrane, all the green stuff, but we use three different membrane names, the outer membrane, the inner membrane, and the thylakoid membrane. And the thylakoid membrane, all the green stuff, is arranged in these little sacs that look separate from each other, but in the cutaway view, you can see that the lumen, the hollow interior, is all continuous. So that's all one chamber inside of all the green things. That's all called the thylakoid space. That's one of three compartments. The compartment that's outside of the thylakoids but inside the inner membrane is the stroma. Be careful with that word because it's very similar to stoma, but an entirely different thing. And then a third compartment is the chamber between the outer membrane and the inner membrane, which is the intermembrane space, same name you gave, the same name that the space has between the outer and inner membrane of the mitochondrion. Not only are these different compartments, but they're filled with fluids of different chemical composition, just like for a mitochondrion. All right, so that's the anatomy. Let's go on to the process of photosynthesis, slide 3. Now think back to one of the first slides in the previous chapter, when I showed you that slide of the ecosystem and the reciprocal relationship between the two processes studied in these two chapters. There's a reciprocal relationship between the complete oxidation of glucose and photosynthesis. And by reciprocal, I mean that each undoes what the other process does. So in a sense, they are the reverse of each other. But importantly, photosynthesis doesn't occur just as oxidation of glucose in reverse. It takes a different path. But remember that even though each of these is several pathways, and so not a single reaction, we can summarize the overall process and pretend that it's happening in one step, in one reaction, right? So do you remember what the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose is? What do you have on the left side of the summary reaction? What are the two requirements for the complete oxidation of glucose? No, I'm talking about not processes. I'm talking about the reactants and the products of the summary reaction. When you pretend that it happens all in one step. That's not a requirement for the complete oxidation of glucose. That's not an input, I mean. What are the two inputs?
Organic molecules.
Well, the whole process is called the complete oxidation of glucose. That's a hint. Glucose is one of the requirements. You have to have glucose. And what else? Oxygen, yes. So if you wrote this as a summary reaction, to balance it stoichiometrically, you would have a glucose, C6H12O6, plus six oxygens become what? What are the outputs? Water, and you need six of those. Six CO2s. That's the materials, input and output. Plus, of course, you have energy that's not a material. But that energy gets stored as ATP, right? It doesn't happen in one step, but that's a summary for the complete oxidation of glucose. The reciprocal process, which is photosynthesis, can be summarized by the complete reversal of that. Right? For photosynthesis to occur, it would have the summary reaction written in the other direction. The inputs are inorganic carbon source, CO2, and water, plus you have to supply energy in the form of sunlight. And when photosynthesis is done, you have organic compounds, the fuel, glucose, and oxygen as a byproduct. That's the reciprocal relationship. Each of the two major processes undoes the other process. But they take different paths. It's not like photosynthesis just reverses everything in cellular respiration and goes down that same path in the other direction. It goes by a completely different path. But the summary reactions are complete opposites of each other. Well, you can see this in a different form in slide 3. Inputs on the top, outputs on the bottom for photosynthesis. Except notice that water is listed as an input and an output, which is technically true. But since you're requiring 12 waters and you're making 6, you can simplify this simply by subtracting 6 from both sides, 6 waters. And that's why I have it written here as water only as an input, none as an output. When you look at it this way, though, in the slide with the arrows, you can see what happens to each individual atom. For instance, if you already knew or were taught that oxygen is a byproduct of photosynthesis, you might naturally think, well, that oxygen just comes from the carbon dioxide that a plant takes in. But notice that that's not true. The oxygen that photosynthesis spits out comes from the water that you put into photosynthesis. And this actually goes along with this reciprocal relationship again. Think about what oxygen does for us. What do we do with our oxygen? It's the final electron acceptor. Well, it doesn't receive just electrons. It receives both electrons and protons, in other words, hydrogen atoms, to make water. Oxygen becomes reduced into water. For the opposite process, the reciprocal process, photosynthesis, water is an electron source, not an electron acceptor. And specifically, it's the hydrogens of the water that are the electron source. So that those hydrogens need to be stripped away from the water, and that leaves oxygen. Okay, so they're doing pretty much the opposite of what we do by using oxygen as an electron acceptor. Okay, now to 4. This is a summary of the overall process of photosynthesis, and notice that unlike the corresponding summary in the previous slideshow, previous chapter, that showed you the summary of the overall process of complete oxidation of glucose, where part of it occurred, glycolysis, in the cytosol, and part of it in a membrane-bounded organelle, that's not true for photosynthesis. There is no part of photosynthesis that occurs in the cytosol. It happens entirely in the chloroplast that we're looking at here. Also, you can kind of see, as more or less columns in this figure, that there are two major parts to photosynthesis. And they have gone by different names over the years. What's labeled here are the light reactions, part one, and the Calvin cycle, part two. Those aren't particularly good names, though. Now, decades ago, the original names for the two parts of photosynthesis were the light reactions and the dark reactions. You don't find those names in modern textbooks because they figured out eventually that when you call something the dark reactions, it kind of implies that darkness is required, and it's not. So we scrapped light reactions and dark reactions as names. The best names for the two are the light-dependent reactions, which this book just calls the light reactions, light-dependent, and that tells you specifically that light is required for that. And then the Calvin cycle can also be called the light-independent reactions, meaning that those can occur whether there's light or not. Okay, so those are the best terms to use for the two parts. Light-dependent reactions, light-independent reactions. Now, ecologically speaking, what is the big deal about photosynthesis? What is it chemically that's occurring in photosynthesis that is so special? Special to all life. It's not that it's producing oxygen that is important. You were right about the first part. It takes carbon dioxide and produces what out of it? The oxygen comes from water. What comes from the carbon dioxide? Yes, sugar. What is the big chemical difference between carbon dioxide and sugar? Yes, which one is organic? Yes, and carbon dioxide is inorganic. That is the big deal about photosynthesis. It transforms carbon from an inorganic source into an organic compound. What is that called specifically? Only producers are able to do that, but what is that process called? No. It's called carbon fixation. To fix carbon means to take carbon from an inorganic molecule and incorporate it into an organic molecule, one that has carbon and hydrogen and other things as well. Okay? No consumer can do that. Consumers have to get their carbon already in organic form by eating things that have these organic molecules in their bodies. A plant makes its own organic molecules, not to feed us, to feed itself. Don't lose track of the fact that a plant has chloroplasts and mitochondria. So it's doing both of the reciprocal processes. It's making its own glucose so that it can then use that glucose as fuel in its mitochondria, or glycolysis and cellular respiration, for the same reason we do. But we have to eat things that already have organic compounds in their bodies. Now that's either a plant, or it's an animal that eats a plant, or it's an animal that eats an animal that eats a plant. It all goes back to producers, though. They feed the rest of the world and allow them to exist. So that's the big deal of photosynthesis, and that carbon fixation part, where the sugar is actually made out of the carbon from CO2, is in the second part. That's the Calvin cycle that does that, the light-independent reactions. Now, if you think back to the three pairs of antonyms that we talked about to describe processes, how would you describe the production of sugar out of CO2? Which of those words would you use?
spontaneous?
No, it's non-spontaneous. But there's better words to use besides spontaneous and non-spontaneous. Just based on what's happening, how would you describe it? You're taking CO2 and making a sugar molecule. Which of those words describes that? Anabolic, yes. Because you're building a more complex thing out of simpler things, right? That's anabolic. Now, energetically, how would you describe it? What goes hand in hand with anabolic? Endergonic. Right? We just got through the exergonic chapter. Fuels are there for the purpose of being broken down, catabolized, for the purpose of releasing energy. That's exergonic. We're doing the reverse here. Building a bigger thing out of smaller things, which is anabolic, and requires energy input to do that. So it's endergonic to build a sugar. So it shouldn't be a surprise to you when you look at this Calvin cycle, which is the light independent reactions, that this requires an input of energy in the form of these energy-carrying molecules. ATP and NADPH, they are both required. Calvin cycle won't operate if you have just one or the other of these. It needs both of these forms of chemical energy-carrying compounds, ATP and NADPH. Now, we haven't talked about NADPH, but you probably have already guessed that it's very similar to NADH, which we talked a great deal about in the previous chapter. And the NADH is which version of the taxi? No, I mean which? No. Yes, which version of the taxi is NADH? No, it's full.
Oh.
NADH is the reduced form. That's the full taxi. That's carrying the energy, right? NAD plus is the empty taxi. Well, plants have a fleet of NAD taxis that they use for cellular respiration. But they also have a separate fleet, you know, like a different taxi company in the same city, that are very similar but have a phosphate on them. So it's NADP rather than just NAD. And they're doing the same job, it's just that those taxis are working for photosynthesis. So remember that it's NAD plus for the empty taxi. Well, in photosynthesis, it's NADP plus. That's the low energy version. When it gets reduced, it gets turned into NADPH and H+. All right? So this is high energy molecule, NADPH. And ATP, as you already know, is high energy. If you give both of these forms of chemical energy to the second process of photosynthesis, then it will happen. But it should make sense to you on endergonic ground. You're building something big out of small. It's going to require energy. Plants use light energy, of course, but plants, or photosynthetic organisms in general, are not able to directly use light energy to make the sugar. That's an endergonic process, but light can't be used directly to fix the carbon. So the plants have to use an energetic middleman, just like we do in the reverse process, right? We can't use the energy that's released from burning our fuels directly to power the endergonic processes that our cells require. So instead, we use an energetic middleman, ATP. Plant is doing the same thing. So light is the original source of energy. But operation of the light-independent reactions requires ATP and NADPH. You don't get ATP and NADPH, though, unless you form them with the first part of photosynthesis, which is the light-dependent reactions. That's where the light is captured, and the energy of that sunlight can directly power the process of phosphorylating ADP back into ATP and reducing NADP plus back into NADPH. Both of those energy-carrying molecules then power the Calvin cycle. That's where the sugar is produced. And that uses those energy-carrying compounds, right? It uses some of the energy from them. So it turns the ATP, the Calvin cycle does, turns the ATP back into ADP and inorganic phosphate. It dephosphorylates it to use it. And it reoxidizes the NADPH back into NADP+. Those lower energy compounds then go back to the light reactions, assuming there's more light coming in, and get recharged back into ATP and NADPH over and over. So this second part where the sugar is produced is called the light independent reactions because it doesn't directly use light. But obviously, if light is cut off for an extended period, eventually the Calvin cycle is going to use up all the available ATP and NADPH, and even the Calvin cycle will come to a halt, right? Until your light shines again and you can transform NADP plus back into NADPH and ATP, ADP back into ATP. Is that all clear? Now, the input for the light-dependent reactions is water. That's the material input. And I said a little bit ago that the reason water is required is that you need electrons from the hydrogen in that water for this particulars of the light reactions aren't shown yet, but we'll get there eventually. And it requires electrons. Hydrogens of water are the source of that. So the water needs to be split. And that's why when you split the hydrogens off of the oxygen that's in water, what you have left over as a byproduct is oxygen. It's not that the plant is trying to produce oxygen, it's just what's left over after you get the useful stuff off of that water. Well, that can't happen, even if you have water, unless you have a steady stream of input energy in the form of sunlight. So water is the material input to the light-dependent reactions. Light is the energetic input into the light-dependent reactions. All right, let's go to 5 and talk about electromagnetic energy. Electromagnetic energy, of course, is energy, but it is kind of weird stuff. It's named for the fact that there's an electrical component and a magnetic component, but there's a duality of nature to it, meaning that in some ways it behaves as a wave, it has wave-like properties, but it also at the same time has particle-like properties, even though it's not made out of matter. So when you consider it as a particle, a single particle of light, which is not material, it's just a little packet of energy, what do we call that single packet? Anyone know?
A photon.
A photon, exactly. A photon is a quantum of electromagnetic energy. When you consider it to be a wave, things that occur in waves can be described by wavelengths. You can measure a wavelength anywhere as long as you're measuring from one part on the wave to the next part that repeats in the pattern. So it could be from there to there. It's going to be the same distance, though. That distance between repeating units is called a wavelength. It has a units of distance, like nanometers, for instance. Well, this top white band here is the overall spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. All that stuff is really the same stuff as far as energy is concerned. It's just that it differs in wavelength. This has a certain wavelength. This one that I'm drawing now has a much shorter wavelength and therefore a higher frequency The frequency is how many waves pass a certain point in a given amount of time. So the shorter the wavelength, the higher the frequency. The longer the wavelength, the lower the frequency. Not only that, the shorter the wavelength, the higher the energy. And at very short wavelengths, that energy can be so high that it can kill us. Gamma rays on this short end of the spectrum, notice, one one-hundred-thousandth of a nanometer, that's a tiny distance. Those things are so powerful, those photons, that they would kill us. But thankfully, they're screened out by the atmosphere, so they don't reach us. X-rays are damaging. Not quite as damaging, but they're still damaging. A little longer wavelength, though. UV is a little bit safer than X-rays, but causes skin cancer. Then you get to this little sliver of the overall spectrum. Just this little sliver from roughly 400 to 700 nanometers happens to be the only kind of electromagnetic radiation that we're able to interpret visually. We can see light in that range. But that visible light is no different from the radio waves or the microwaves or the UV radiation. It's all the same stuff, just at different wavelengths. In the visible range, though, those wavelengths happen to be just the right wavelengths that they cause pigments in our retinas of our eyeballs to change. And that sends a signal to the brain, and that's why we perceive them. We have radio waves going through our bodies all the time, microwaves too. We just can't tell they're there because they don't interact with our eyes. Well, this is a chapter on plants, not on humans, so you might be asking, what does this have to do with plants? Well, it's by coincidence, the pigments that plants use are similar to the pigments that our eyes use. And therefore, this humanly visible portion of the electromagnetic spectrum is also the photosynthetically important range. It's humanly visible light that gets absorbed by plants and other photosynthetic organisms. I'll only be able to go through this slide at the end, but in slide 6 we can see light being shown on a chloroplast. Now, we typically say things like the plant is green, as though greenness is a property of the plant. The plant is not green, actually. Greenness is an event that happens in the human brain. It happens when light of a certain wavelength strikes our eyes. That creates the perception of greenness in our brain. Okay? Now, the reason that a plant looks green to us is that when you shine white light on it, which is a combination of all the wavelengths, white is the combination of all colors, all of those different wavelengths will strike the plant. But the pigment that's in chloroplasts, which we'll get to in the next time, absorb some of those photons of the right wavelengths. In other words, light of the correct color, even though the light doesn't have color any more than the plant does. Light in the blue range and the red range get absorbed well. And that's important because unless those photons get absorbed, the plant doesn't get the energy. So white light is coming down onto the plant. Blue and red light don't make it out of the plant. They get absorbed. The green wavelength light does not get absorbed. Instead, it bounces off to our eyes, and that's why they look green to us. It would be just like someone shining green light into our eyes without it hitting anything. Okay? So the greenness isn't part of the plant, it's part of us, but that's the reason it happens.